This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 21st, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in Haiti, attention turns toward the 1.5 million people left homeless by last week's earthquake. We'll take a look at the efforts from African and Latin American countries in long-term recovery.
Much to the credit of Venezuela and Cuba, they have been in Haiti for quite a long time. Cuban doctors know the ground in Haiti. They know where the need is, and they have been there to meet that need.
Obama announces new oversight of the banking system, and the U.S. Supreme Court issues a decision that could allow more corporate money into politics. Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates made a visit to Pakistan today, his first in over 2 years. He pressured the government to continue the fight against all extremist groups and did public outreach in an effort to improve the sentiment towards the U.S. Pakistan's people have been increasingly critical of U.S. tactics in the country, including drone strikes. In Mexico, details are slowly emerging about a massacre that took place yesterday in a Durango state prison. Shannon Young reports.
The death toll from Wednesday's prison riot rose to 24 today when an injured inmate died from a 9mm gunshot wound. The fight over control of the overcrowded prison mostly involved gang members affiliated with the rival Sinaloa and Gulf cartels. The country's large organized crime syndicates use gangs to control territory not only in the streets, but also in the prisons, which have increasingly become grounds for recruitment. Yesterday's prison massacre is at least the third of its kind in the past year. Fierce territorial disputes between rival cartels over the control of Durango State and Ciudad Juarez have left thousands dead in the past 2 years. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
Sectarian violence in Nigeria has eased after 4 days of fighting between Christians and Muslims left more than 200 people dead. The government has backed off on strict curfews, and religious leaders are beginning to arrange burials for the victims. Thousands of residents from the northern city of Jos fled their homes in the fighting. The British government is doubling the fees for some migrants applying to settle in the UK. They're also offering those who can afford it fast-track visa renewals for £15,000, or about $25,000. From London, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
The visa process for non-Europeans who want to settle in the UK is slow, humiliating, and strict. Today's price rises will make the migration process even slower for poorer migrants and their family members. But that won't be the case for wealthy migrants. Now, for a $25,000 fee, the UK Border Agency is offering to visit and sort out their immigration papers in person. They'll also get an on-the-spot decision. There have always been different rules for wealthy applicants. Millionaires can settle here if they invest over $1 million within 3 months of their entry into the country. Wealthy applicants who can prove they've got capital of more than $300,000 to set up a business and employ a minimum of 2 people are also admitted. Migrant support groups argue today's changes will make an already discriminatory system even worse. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Ozone from Asia is drifting over the western United States. That's according to a report published today in the journal Nature. From Eugene, Oregon, FSRN's Rachel McDonald reports.
Scientists from the University of Colorado and Washington collaborated with other researchers to analyze large sets of ozone data captured since 1984. They found a significant increase in springtime ozone, 14% from 1995 to 2008. University of Washington Bothell scientist Dan Jaffe says it's the first time Asian pollution has been directly linked to ozone over the United States. Despite the study, Sally Marcos with the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency in Eugene, Oregon, says Western residents must still look for local solutions.
Some of those pollutants do originate here and stay here, and we have way more control over what we do locally than something happening in another country across the ocean.
Marcos says ozone problems in Oregon tend to increase in the summer. Researchers say the ozone drift from Asia could complicate U.S. efforts to lower ozone levels at home. Rachel McDonald, FSRN.
West Virginia activists at the new Coal River Mountain surface mine took to the trees this morning to halt blasting. The move comes as polluted water from a coal slurry retention pond continues to leak into West Virginia's Gauley River after an earthen dam there failed on Monday. FSRN's Evan Davis has the latest.
Three activists with environmental groups Mountain Justice and Climate Ground Zero ascended trees in the path of access road construction at the Coal River Mountain Mine. The tree sit delayed operations, but as of mid-afternoon, loggers had cut down adjacent trees and police had arrested two of the three activists. The road being blocked by the tree sitters would connect the Coal River Mountain Mine to Brushy Fork, the largest coal byproduct retention pond in West Virginia. A breach in a similar dam on Monday in another part of the state has activists particularly worried about Brushy Fork. Downstream residents' communities 14 miles away could be destroyed if that dam fails, according to an industry evacuation plan. Complicating the situation, a Massey Energy subsidiary plans to begin blasting in areas just 100 feet from the dam. Evan Davis, Free Speech Radio News.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The U.S. Coast Guard partially reopened the damaged seaport in Port-au-Prince, Haiti today, and the U.S. military is now operating four airports in the area, Port-au-Prince and Jacmel in Haiti, and San Isidro and Barahona in the Dominican Republic. Meanwhile, attention is turning to the 1.5 million people left homeless by last week's earthquake. The UN announced today that it will relocate survivors to temporary tented villages outside the capital. According to the UN International Organization for Migration, there are nearly 450 improvised settlements in Port-au-Prince alone. Almost none have adequate water or sanitation facilities. Much of the attention in Haiti has been focused on the U.S. in the rescue and recovery efforts, but other countries, especially from Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America, have played important life-saving roles, often getting in early after the disaster with members who have had experience in Haiti. We're joined by Nicole Lee, president of TransAfrica Forum, an advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
Let's begin with relief efforts so far. How do you assess the relief efforts to the devastating earthquake in Haiti at this point, coming to the end of the second week after the earthquake?
Well, people are certainly willing. Individuals, governments are certainly willing to send aid. I think the real question is aid actually getting to the people? And the answer today is no, it's not getting to the people that need it the most. We know that aid is sitting in the airport. We know that aid is flying in the sky, and those planes are unable to land. What has been truly amazing is that so many countries, even countries that would be considered developing countries, have offered aid and assistance. Liberia, for example, has pledged $50,000 to the effort. Now, $50,000 is certainly less than the millions that we're hearing from other countries, but considering that Liberia itself is really attempting to come out of the shadows of poverty and war, it's quite a testament to the relationship between the African continent and Haiti that they are actually able to make a pledge. Other countries, certainly Rwanda, has made a pledge. South Africa has sent in search and rescue teams. And so certainly the African continent, as well as many, many Latin American countries and the countries of the Caribbean, are very much involved. The question is the relief they're sending actually getting to people? And unfortunately, that is not the case right now, and people continue to die that survived the earthquake but have sustained injuries that have gone untreated, and so they have become they've succumbed to sepsis or other infections, and those infections are killing them.
Now, you mentioned the aid and relief coming from other countries around the world. Much of the attention is on the United States and the policy there. But coming from African countries and coming from Latin American countries, we had reports that medical teams were in early from Cuba, from Venezuela. What happened differently than the aid teams that were not able to get in right away?
Well, I think that it's important to note that much to the credit of Venezuela and Cuba, they have been in Haiti for quite a long time. The Cuban doctor program has frankly been one of the most important programs that has helped prop up a very fledgling healthcare system in Haiti, a public healthcare system. And the Cuban doctor program has ensured that Haitians both in urban and rural areas are able to get health care. Cuban doctors know the ground in Haiti. They know where the need is, and they have been there to meet that need.
And looking ahead to long-term recovery and aid in Haiti, the International Monetary Fund has now said that the $100 million loan to Haiti is now going to be a grant, and there will be a cancellation of debt to the IMF. How do you see that move?
I think it's an indication that certainly public opinion regarding these IMF loan programs has really turned. This notion that Haiti should be taking on loans and who owes who is an issue that has been swirling around Haiti for quite a long time. Certainly the international community, France in particular, and the U.S. certainly owe Haiti much more than Haiti should even consider to have to pay back. And so I think that there's a recognition of that. I think there's also a recognition that to ask a country that has just experienced a calamity of apocalyptic proportions to take out a loan is really, frankly, distasteful. And I think people realize that. And I guess, fortunately, the IMF this time around realized that that was not going to be a favorable move for them, and so they have now said it is going to be a grant. But what I'm most interested in the long term is making sure that the outstanding quote-unquote loans that Haiti owes are obliterated. And I don't even want to use the word forgiven, because Haiti should have never had to pay these loans in the first place. That those loans be erased, and that Haiti be given the aid and recovery monies that they need.
We've been speaking with Nicole Lee, president of TransAfrica Forum, based in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The long-term recovery in Haiti could also depend on Haitians who are living in the United States and sending money and support back home. Immigrant rights groups have been calling on the Obama administration to suspend deportations to the country. And last week, Obama did just that. Today, the administration is authorizing the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services to issue temporary protected status to more than 100,000 undocumented Haitian nationals living in the United States. But not all Haitians in the U.S. are going to enjoy the benefits of the temporary status. FSRN reporter Christopher Rios of the Community News Production Institute has more from New York.
In 1989, Jean Moncheville, a Haitian immigrant, was arrested and convicted of a drug felony. Sentenced to 30 years in prison, Moncheville was paroled in 10 years for good behavior and released from prison. Following his release, Moncheville started a business and turned his life around. Now married and a father of four U.S.-born children, Moncheville has been active in the Haitian community in New York, but because of a retroactive immigration law, he now faces deportation after living in the United States for 24 years. While the Obama administration halted the repatriation of people like Moncheville because of unsafe conditions in Haiti, his future is uncertain. Reverend Michael Ellick of Judson Memorial Church is an immigrant rights advocate who organized a vigil calling for Moncheville's release.
The situation in Haiti highlights what's kind of going on with our immigration system in a really key way. The administration came out and said they were going to stop all deportations, which basically, that takes so many Haitians who are already in detention centers, like Jean Montreval, and it leaves them there indefinitely. This is unconstitutional.
Starting today, undocumented Haitians living in the United States prior to the January 12th earthquake can submit applications for the 18-month temporary protected status. Christopher Bentley with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services explains.
Temporary protective status is a way that the United States government can allow individuals from other countries to remain in the United States so they can live here and work here because conditions in their home country aren't safe for their return. We estimate that the population in the United States right now that could apply is somewhere between 100 and 200,000 individuals. So we're making the necessary arrangements just in our business model to be able to handle that influx of new applications.
Bentley said that while all Haitian nationals can apply for temporary protected status, eligibility is determined on a case-by-case review. But for Haitians like Moncheville, who have criminal records, temporary protected status is more complex. Matthew Blaisdell is a recent law graduate and immigrant rights advocate with the Haitian community.
If they've got misdemeanors or what's considered for immigration purposes to be an aggravated felony, they're not covered. If it's just a minor immigration violation, they very well might be covered. TPS will not cure that violation. It's only saying, you know, it would be unconscionable to remove you until the status is not removed. And then as soon as it's done, we're sending you back.
Citizenship and Immigration Services has partnered with community-based organizations across the country to share information about the temporary protected status application process. More information is available at uscis.gov or by calling 800-375-5283. With assistance from Abdoulaye Ba, I'm Christopher Rios, FSRN, New York.
The influence of big money in politics may be getting bigger. In its ruling on Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, the U.S. Supreme Court stripped away some limits on corporate campaign spending. Public interest groups are criticizing the decision. They say opening the possibility to more corporate money in politics is a threat to democracy. Tanya Snyder has the story.
The case involves Citizens United, a conservative group that wanted to air a documentary criticizing Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primary campaign. But the FEC blocked it, saying corporate-funded broadcasts like these couldn't run so close to the election, according to the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Thursday, in a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court removed significant limits on how corporations or labor unions can influence election campaigns.
Right now, a corporation cannot take money, just write a check out of its treasury and fund a whole campaign against a candidate. After today, they can.
Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer.
Let me give you an example. So somebody's fighting the drug industry, and they decide to make an example of this candidate. They put $50 million of ads against this person. He loses. How many others are going to go oppose the drug industry? It's poisonous to our democracy.
The Supreme Court Thursday upheld requirements that corporations and organizations disclose their campaign spending, and it upheld the soft money ban in McCain-Feingold. But it allows independent expenditures on campaigns for the first time in decades. Nick Neihardt is the president of Public Campaign, which advocates against money in politics.
Deep pocket interests can now spend as much money as they want in elections without restriction to say vote for or vote against a candidate. They still can't give direct contributions to a campaign, but in some ways that doesn't matter as much when they can spend unlimited amounts of money influencing what voters see and hear leading up to the election.
Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the 57-page opinion for the majority. Kennedy is a Reagan appointee and is generally considered a centrist judge. Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Breyer dissented. Clarence Thomas joined with the majority but wrote a separate opinion against the part of the ruling that upheld the disclosure requirements. The court has spilled more ink on this decision than on any other so far this term, and the case also attracted a record number of amicus briefs or letters from organizations supporting one side or another. The decision has enormous significance for how our democracy works. The president of Citizens United, David Bossie, says he's been waiting for this ruling for years.
And be told by the bureaucrats at the Federal Election Commission, you can't do that. You have no First Amendment rights. And I think today is a wonderful day to tell the folks over at the Federal Election Commission that they work for the people. And the people don't work for them.
Critics like Jerry Hebert of the Campaign Legal Center say this decision erases any veneer the court had of objectivity. Conservatives often criticize liberals for being activist judges, but Hebert says it goes both ways.
Today's decision is the most radical and destructive campaign finance decision in the history of the United States Supreme Court. The mask of judicial restraint is off.
This ruling has some members of Congress worried that they'll have to spend even more time attending gala fundraisers and less time representing their constituents in Congress. Congressional leaders reportedly advise members to spend 20 hours a week raising money for re-election, starting their first week in office. Even that might not be enough to fight off ad campaigns funded by corporations with deep pockets and an axe to grind. One of the most controversial aspects of the decision is what it says about corporate constitutional rights. Bob Edgar of Common Cause and a former member of Congress.
The idea that the Supreme Court is deciding that corporations are individuals, I think, is an outrage. There are corporations in this country that are larger than nations.
This case doesn't just say that money is speech and therefore protected by the First Amendment. It says that corporations are people and therefore they're protected by the First Amendment. Democracy advocates outraged by the decision launched the campaign to legalize democracy Thursday, the same day the decision was announced. That campaign seeks to remove the definition of corporations as people. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
President Obama announced a new oversight of the banking system today. It's an effort to prevent banks from becoming too big to fail. This announcement comes as Goldman Sachs announced it made more in the fourth quarter of 2009 than in any quarter in 140 years. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Tapping into voter anger over a struggling economy, bank profits, and end-of-the-year bonuses, President Obama is focusing his message on Wall Street. With Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and other members of Obama's economic team and members of Congress standing behind him, President Obama expressed outrage over banking practices.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform.
His proposal would create separation between commercial banks and investment firms. Commercial banks would be prevented from owning, investing, or advising hedge funds and private equity funds. Furthermore, banks would no longer be able to use customers' money to invest in financial markets for its own accounts, a phenomenon called proprietary trading.
When banks benefit from the safety net that taxpayers provide, which includes lower cost capital, it is not appropriate for them to turn around and use that cheap money to trade for profit.
This proposal is intended to prevent financial firms from becoming too big to fail. Heather McGee is the Washington office director at Demos, a progressive policy organization. She says she's thrilled at the president's announcement. She explains how commercial banks like J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup would be impacted.
Banks are going to have to justify all of those trading profits, and the ones that aren't client-driven, that aren't from the investment bank clients, are going to have to be limited and banned.
She says investment firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley would no longer be able to receive the same benefits of banks.
Basically, it's saying you shouldn't get taxpayer benefits to speculate in the financial markets.
The House already passed financial reform. These new regulations are included in the bill, but are voluntary. President Obama is urging the Senate to make these rules mandatory. Republicans have issued cautious opposition. This proposal is likely to be opposed from the banking industry. In a statement, President of the Financial Services Forum, Rob Nickel, said, "Proprietary trading did not lead to the financial crisis." He also said, quote, "Large institutions provide significant value to customers that smaller institutions simply cannot provide." This is the latest attempt by President Obama to crack down on Wall Street. Earlier this year, he proposed a tax on firms that have received TARP bailout money. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Scientists on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have acknowledged that some data about glacier recession in the Himalayas did not meet their own standards for scientific rigor. The admission comes after the IPCC drew criticism about the quality of their research. In a statement, the group said this instance of poor scientific judgment does not affect their overall assessment that climate change and the resulting loss of glaciers will have severe and negative effects on human populations. And as FSRN's Shanawaz Khan reports, scientists and residents alike are already seeing the changes in the hilly regions of Kashmir.
Just two decades ago, the valley of Kashmir would get snowfall in early winter, which would freeze and cover the landscape until spring. Nowadays, snowfall is not only thin, but often late. Just one of the changes climate change has brought in the region. Shakil Ramshu is an assistant professor at the Geology and Geophysics Department of the University of Kashmir, Ramshu says the average temperature in the region has increased by more than a degree in the last 100 years.
If you look at the data from 1969 that's available up to now, we are seeing that the temperatures have increased over the region. And this increase in the temperatures, particularly the winter temperatures, have increased. And this increase in the temperature has resulted in reduced snowfall and increase in melting of the glaciers in the region.
For the last 5 years, Ramshu has been studying the glaciers in the region. He says the major threat the region faces due to climate change is the melting of its glaciers lying high up in the Himalayas, which go on to feed almost one-fifth of the world population.
This is a water tower of Asia, Himalayas, Kashmir Himalayas or other Himalayas. And waters from here go to Pakistan, to Bangladesh, to China and all that. So I believe that it is going to have serious consequences on all the sectors and which are dependent on the waters. Let us talk about the agriculture, let us talk about the horticulture here, even the hydropower. It is already impacting these sectors. If you look at this small region here, you see people are switching from agriculture to horticulture.
In 2007, an intergovernmental panel on climate change report said that glaciers in the Himalayas were receding faster and could disappear by the year 2035. The report has since fallen into controversy, with many scientists, including Ramshu, finding the deadline inaccurate. An Indian government-endorsed study last year contested IPCC findings, but admitted that glaciers in Kashmir Himalayas were receding faster. While the scientists and policymakers contest threats and findings, the impact of climate change on ground can hardly be ignored. Change of seasonal weather and water scarcity is affecting the farmers in Kashmir already. Ghulam Mahiuddin Bhatt is a farmer in the Kashmir's southern district, Pulwama.
We had a lot of land used for agriculture, and I too had some land used for agriculture. But we were facing a water shortage for the last 10 to 15 years, so we switched to horticulture.
Like Bhatt, his neighbor Ghulam Rasul Ganai also abandoned paddy farming for apple farming this year because of water scarcity. He will have to wait for more than 5 years before his converted field bears fruit.
I had not switched to horticulture, but most of my neighbors had. We were facing water scarcity, especially during the crop season. Last year, the problem was too profound, so I ultimately gave up and planted apple trees in my land.
Kashmir's prized saffron crops have suffered too. It's just one of the three places in the world, besides Iran and Spain, known for saffron. Water scarcity is straining the crops, and some of the saffron farmers are now looking at irrigation measures to save their rare crops. International aid group Mercy Corps has recently been involved in creating awareness about the problem.
Unfortunately, the people who are most impacted by climate change are those who were least responsible for creating this phenomena.
Usman Ahmed is the mission director for Mercy Corps, overseeing operations in Kashmir.
At the local level, the awareness is very important because there are solutions that are available for the farming community to become more resilient. Farmers need to become much more able to use weather reports, for example, a simple solution, using midterm weather forecasts to be able to predict when they should sow their plants, when they should harvest their plants, and also to be able to predict what types of impacts they may be seeing because our calendar doesn't work right now.
While Ahmed says local awareness will help the community survive the impact, the real solution, he says, lies in large-scale coordinated efforts globally. And both Ramshu and Ahmed say they are disappointed with the outcome of the Copenhagen summit, where world leaders failed to reach a legally binding treaty to lower carbon emissions. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar, Kashmir.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina.